Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's in the Video Poker Hall of Fame, and he has written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the Video Poker for Winners computer software. Michael Shackelford is the force behind the websites Wizard of Odds, Wizard of Vegas, and Wizard of Macau. An actuary by profession, Michael has been analyzing the whole gamut of casino games since 1995. His Wizard of Odds website explains the best strategies for 140 different casino games. Michael is also the author of Gambling 102, The Best Strategies for All Casino Games, and is a former adjunct professor of gaming math at UNLV. The goal of the show is that, by listening, you will be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Mike.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer. My usual co-host, Michael Shackelford, is climbing Mount Whitney today, along with his son and a backgammon-playing buddy. Last week, Shaq mentioned that he just might play some backgammon halfway up the mountain, and he also said his buddy was a better player. Personally, I can think of easier ways to lose at backgammon than to go climb a mountain. But that's Michael. Sitting in for Michael is blackjack and poker gambling legend Arnold Schneider. Using a baseball analogy, this is like having an all-star coming off the bench as a pinch hitter. Good evening, Arnold, and welcome.
I think it's more like having one of the guys from the old-timers game come in to pinch hit. So,
okay, well, I hope your cane doesn't get in the way then. For our guest tonight, we have good news and bad news. The good news is that poker player and author Ed Miller is here tonight talking about his new book, Playing the Player. The bad news is that poker player and author Ed Miller is here tonight. Ed was in this week's World Series of Poker main event and came very close to not being here because he was still in the tournament. We'll talk to him about that soon. We got some emails sent to gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com, and one I want to share with you. The first one, actually two I want to share with you. The first one was, they want to know how often you are dealt a sequential royal flush at video poker. In round numbers, you're dealt a royal every 650,000 hands, assuming you're talking about a 52-card deck. There are 120 different sequences that those five cards can be in. For example, the ace can be at all the way to the left, second to the left, in the middle, second to the right, or all the way to the right. The king can be in one of those spots, the queen, the jack, and the 10. 120 of those, two of them are sequential, either left to right or right to left. So that means one out of 60 is sequential. Multiplying 60 by 650 means that the odds against you getting a dealt sequential on your next hand are 1 in 39 million. When this happened, players take out their iPhone, take a picture, post it online with a comment of, "Wow, I just beat 39 million to 1 odds." When they say this, though, they're not right. The 1 in 39 million refers to the odds on your very next hand. It's a different situation entirely when you're talking about if you're ever going to get a dealt sequential in your entire playing career. My best recollection is that I've been dealt 32 royal flushes in my career so far. That might be off by one or two, but I think it's close. I don't keep a master list anywhere. A couple years ago, I did sit down and list them in my mind anyway, and since then, I've kept an accurate record. One of those dealt royals was sequential. It happened to be in spades. It was on a $5 and a shoe machine several years ago. I may hit another one before I'm through. Who knows? It's meaningless to try to figure out what are the odds after something has happened. A lot of people want to believe that what just happened to them was really, 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 really special. The truth of the matter is that unusual things are guaranteed to happen to you tomorrow. You just don't know what they're going to be now. Like maybe the first hand you play, you're going to be dealt in order: king of hearts, three of clubs, four of spades, queen of diamonds, jack of clubs. That is neither more nor less unusual than being dealt in order ace of hearts, king of hearts, queen of hearts, jack of hearts, ten of hearts. It's just that the first one is kind of a nothing hand, and we forget about it, and the second one pays a bunch, and it's pretty exciting. Arnold, Ed, any comments in other gambling forums when people want to know what the odds are afterwards?
Yeah, back when I was publishing Blackjack Forum, the magazine, in print, I used to get a lot of letters from people, players who would write to me with very similar type thing. They say, well, this is what happened at the blackjack table. I got this and the dealer got this, then the next hand I got this and the dealer got, run through some series of hands, and then, my buddy who knows probability told me, it's a billions to one. Was I cheated? And it's like, well, you could give me any series of hands and it's billions of one against that happening, because you're giving me these exact cards you got and the dealer got. And trying to figure out the probability on something after it happens. It's like, it's always a billion to one against it.
Yeah, sure. In poker, people are always complaining about the hands that they miss. Like, I've missed 20 flush draws in a row, and the odds of hitting your flush draw with two cards to go are about one in three. And people are like, I've missed the last 40 flush draws. Whenever I hear that, first of all, I'm like, no, you didn't. You did not count correctly, because they're always off by a factor of about 10, I think. And then the second thing is, it's going to happen. I mean, if you play long enough, you're going to have a streak where you miss them 10 in a row, and there you go.
I'm wondering whether video poker players or poker players are bigger whiners. I don't know who would win that one. The next email I want to talk about, it might have come from Ed's brother-in-law, but I'm going to read it anyway. He wrote, I'm currently playing limit hold'em and want to shift to low limit, no limit hold'em. Please ask Ed Miller which is the best book for me to study so I can do this.
Well, I've written a few books on no limit hold'em. I'll recommend one of my books because I'm a little bit shameless. I think the best book for someone who's just transferring over from limit hold'em that I've written is probably Professional No Limit Hold'em, Volume 1. It's by Matt Flynn, Sonny Mehta, and me. And it kind of gives you the framework of how to play No Limit Hold'em on a fundamental level. It kind of teaches you about stack sizes and how to all the things that you don't have to worry about in Limit Hold'em, and gives you a real good fundamental for that. So that would be the book I recommend, Professional No Limit Hold'em.
Would that book teach you ABC poker, which is a phrase we're going to be using later in today's conversation?
Sure. I mean, it teaches you certainly the basics of what an ABC poker strategy would entail, sure.
Good. All right. So tell your brother-in-law hi for us. All right. On last week's show, we spoke about Mikhail Smirnov, who discarded 4/8 face up on an all-in bet on the river in the face of what might have been a straight flush in the million-dollar buy-in one-drop tournament. Shaq and I finally agreed on a side bet whether or not there was actually a straight flush there. I put up $20 and took the yes. Shaq put up $60 and took the no. One of my motivations for making the bet is that Phil Gaffon was at the table and afterwards said it wasn't a terrible move to fold the quads. So I'll take that as my bet isn't too far off. It turns out that we'll never know because that round wasn't televised, and even if the guy says, well, I had it or I didn't have it, you may or may not be telling the truth.
Okay, I don't know anything about that hand, but do we know if there were 3 to the straight flush or 4 to the straight flush on
3.
The board? Were they sequential?
No.
No, he had to have a 9 and a 10 specifically.
Yep. Oh. Mm-hmm. It was one combination of straight flush.
And so anyway.
I wouldn't have folded, but that's just me. I probably would have busted out right there.
You were at the World Series this week, Ed. Were people still talking about that or not?
I think it came up once because somebody made quads at my table and then somebody made a remark about folding, but that was about it.
All right, so since we've been talking to Ed, it's probably time to introduce him. This is Ed Miller's second visit to Gambling with an Edge. Ed is a poker player, a poker coach, and a poker writer, specializing in writing about low-limit live games. Tonight we're going to be talking about his new book, Playing the Player, Moving Beyond ABC Poker to Dominate Your Opponents, which is available in paperback and ebook format on his website, NotedPokerAuthority.com. Ed Miller, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thank you very much, Bob. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Now, you almost didn't make it here tonight.
Yeah.
You were in the main event of the World Series, where day three is going on as we speak. You apparently busted out late on day two.
Mm-hmm.
So how close did you come to having a damn good excuse for standing us up?
Oh, well, I came really, really close, actually, because the hand I busted out on, I still had a healthy stack, and I went for a check raise all in on the river. So I thought I had the best hand, and when I kind of went over the hand in my head at the time, and then afterwards, I think it's about 2-1 that I have the best hand when he calls. So, you know, 2 out of 3 times I have a big stack and there's no chance I'm here. And 1 out of 3, here I am. So,
and how close was that to the end of the day?
It was about half an hour left. So, I was.
So, I'm sorry you lost. I'm happy you're here. I can't really rank those exactly as to whether I'm sorry or happier. All right. Now, there are thousands of poker books out there. To whom is Playing the Player addressed, and briefly, what makes the book different from others?
Sure. Playing the Player is written for people who play, mostly it's people who play 1, 2, 1, 3, 2, 5, even 5, 10 blind cash no limit hold'em games. And it's for people who kind of have learned the basics. You know, they know how not to pay off people who, you know, have big hands. They know you don't play every hand. They know, you know, people I think who kind of know how to fold. That's kind of the first thing you learn at poker. You know how to fold. This is for to take you to the next step. This is to teach you how to actually begin really making money at the game, how to look at what your opponents are doing, figure out what they're doing wrong, and then exploit it. So it's for anyone who kind of breaks even at those games, wins a little bit, and wants to win a lot more.
Uh-huh. All right. Now, how much is Playing the Player advice specific to low-limit hold'em live play? And how much would be applicable to, say, larger stakes games and no-limit hold'em?
It's applicable to any stakes because you find all different kinds of players at every stakes. The only difference between when you move up is that there's more pros at the table, generally speaking. But there's plenty of bad players, you know, as high as I've ever played. And even sort of the medium strength players. And so this book is about how to get the most out of beating really the medium strength players, the guys who are not just giving it away, but who yet still have very significant flaws in the way they play.
So even this week when you were in the main event, there
Absolutely.
Were several players
Oh, tons
there.
Of them, yeah.
All right. Now, how would this be applicable to playing in tournaments as opposed to cash games?
Well, it focuses on what we call deeper stack play. So it focuses on no limit hold'em where there's play after the flop. You see the flop, there's betting. You see the turn, there's still betting. You see the river, there's still betting. And it focuses on the patterns that people have in those betting rounds throughout a hand. So whenever when tournaments start, they start out that way. Everyone starts out deep stack. And so I would say it's very applicable then. As tournaments go on, particularly smaller buy-in tournaments, everybody gets short stacked very quickly, and it becomes just all in preflop. I call, all in preflop. I fold, and in that case, the book's not really about that type of poker. But whenever there's plenty of money behind and there's betting on all the streets, that's when the book really applies.
All right, how would it be applicable to playing other games than no limit hold'em? Would it be applicable to Pot Limit Omaha?
Not as much. Pot Limit Omaha, not so much, really. Pot Limit Omaha is a little bit. You know, there would be nuggets in there if you read it and you're like, I'm a Pot Limit Omaha player, let me try to translate this to my game. There would be little bits of insight. It's poker is poker, but the patterns that people have at Pot Limit Omaha, the specifics of it, I think are pretty different.
All right, Arnold. Your books are about tournament play.
Yeah.
So you read Ed's book.
Yeah, I did.
So first of all, what do you think of his book, and how is the different things that he's talking about in his book applicable to tournaments in your mind?
I pretty much agree with what he said. Early in a tournament when everybody has chips, very applicable. Now I actually have played in a few pot limit Omaha tournaments, but I find them pretty weird, being that almost all my play has been in no limit hold'em tournaments. So I can't talk about them, but I think that essentially you have the same types of players in tournaments that you have at poker tables. You have tight players, you have loose players, you have aggressive players. And his book talks about identifying these players' types and how you identify what you look for in these types of players. And they're the types of things that are even so obvious to people. The guy who's always coming in with a raise, and way too often to always have big cards or even decent cards. You start to recognize him, okay, he's loose, okay, he's aggressive. And Ed talks in his book about how you identify him and how you play against him. And a lot of the advice in there would be very applicable in tournaments. There are a lot of bad players in tournaments. In fact, I think there are worse players in tournaments. I'm going to guess there are worse players in tournaments than there are in cash games. Again, I've done a certain amount of play in cash games, but never at high stakes. And you know, it's probably in the hundreds of hours rather than the thousands. So I'm not a cash game specialist at all. But there are a lot of bad players in tournaments. One of the reasons is everybody going into a tournament knows up front what the cost is. And if it's a small buy-in tournament, they know, well, okay, this is a $75 tournament. Well, a lot of people can put up $75 to play in a tournament, and $75 isn't going to go that far in a cash game. You tend to want to have more cash than that if you're playing. But in a tournament, you can get into a tournament with a couple hundred players, and you're trying to make a couple thousand maybe on if you get to the end. So tournaments attract players who don't have a lot of money. They want to know, what's the most I can lose here? Especially in Las Vegas, you've got casinos. I'd say just about every casino that has a poker room is running tournaments every day, some of them multiple tournaments. These tournaments have buy-ins ranging from like $20 to a couple hundred dollars. And you're just going to see a range of players that there are people in there that really don't even know what they're doing. They're on vacation. Oh, hey, here's a tournament. You know, I've been watching them on TV now for 2 years. I think I'll play in this one. And, the thing is that, like, the majority of players in the tournament are poker players. And tournament play is different from poker play, but you still see the same types. And, so I think that a lot of his book would be applicable for tournament players.
All right, good. Ed, in a recent column in Card Player magazine, you addressed identifying players who are stuck and steaming, acting differently than they normally do. Your current book talks about identifying what players normally do without addressing steaming per se. So how do these two aspects of reading opponents work together?
Sure. Well, people kind of do different things when they're steaming. The kind of classic steaming is they just can't wait to put their chips in the pot, and they'll just put them in a ridiculous way, just huge bets, just, randomly. And once you'll see a switch, like someone will be playing normally, make normal bet sizes, and then all of a sudden they're shoving $100 every time they make a bet, in like a 2-5 game where they would normally bet 20 or 25, and now it's like they're just tossing money into the pot. To beat those players, the adjustment, it's the same kind of thinking that goes into playing the player, except it's the kind of error that you only see when people are frustrated. But it's, the thinking is the same way, and that one I think most people can figure out how to beat that. You just wait until you have a hand that's significantly better on average than you think whatever this person's bar is for throwing money in the pot, and you just call. So that's that. Some people, when they steam, they get actually really they sort of crawl into a shell. They all the edge to their game goes away completely. They've been beaten three or four times taking risks, and now they don't want to take any risks. And those people you can just pummel. You can just bet and watch them fold and watch them fold. So there's different ways that people react to steaming, but it's all the same thought process for how to attack the errors that they're making.
Arnold, your books talk about needing to have a table presence in order to identify where players are right now. And I think I remember you saying that if you can't figure out where they are right now, you should just hang it up.
Yeah, I think I was talking about... See, tournaments are different from cash games. Cash games, if you get low on chips, you buy more chips. In a cash game, everybody can be sitting there with enough chips to play. If somebody's not, well, that's his choice. You know, or unless, of course, he's out of money and he's just an idiot that shouldn't probably be playing. In a tournament, you can't get more chips. And so the way that players feel changes based on their chip stacks. So as you go through, let's say you get a few hours into the tournament, you're going to see a couple players might have very large stacks, a couple players are desperately short, some are in the average range. And you should be able to judge how this player feels about the chips that he has. For example, a very tight player is not all that concerned with having a short stack, usually because he's just basically looking for the cards he wants to play, and when he gets them, he'll play. And otherwise, you know, he's not going to do anything different. A loose player...
Until he has to start going all in.
Yes, until he has to. And the tighter he is, the longer it'll take him to realize he should start doing something. A loose player who gets short stacked is very impatient. Very often they will just immediately start pounding and figure like, okay, either I'm going to get something here or I'm not. Either I'm going to steal the blinds and annies or I'm not. But basically, I'm not going to sit here like this because I can't play my game. And generally, if you're talking about a no-limit hold'em tournament, the loose player has a more successful attitude towards getting what he needs than the tight player. Once you get short-stacked in a tournament, you basically are completely at the mercy of the cards. A good loose player will do anything to avoid getting short stacked, but sometimes it just happens. Sometimes somebody sucks out on him, he gets into a cooler situation where, you know, he had the kings, somebody else had the aces or had the queens and hit a set, or, you know, there's so many ways that anybody gets short stacked. There's really only one player that wins it, and, you know, everybody busts out in between. But you should be able to look around a table and see how the players react to their chip stacks. And this tells you an awful lot about how to play against the players. If you see it's a tight player and he's just going to continue to be tight, he's going to wait there forever. A loose player, any decent hand, when this player is, you know, going for it, go ahead and mix it up with him.
A suited 7-9 is good enough for him.
Very, very, yeah. In fact, that would be considered a pretty damn good hand.
Yeah, this happened a number of times while I was playing the main event. You see people, they just kind of flip a switch in their head. They're sort of playing one way, and then they lose a hand or whatever, and their stack gets below a certain threshold. And, you know, as Arnold was saying, when you get short stacked, it becomes sort of correct to shove with weaker hands, you know, for fold equity to try to win the blinds and the annies. But this is not. There's a line, like there's a correct strategy, a mathematically correct strategy, and a lot of times these guys just go way overboard. And I saw that happen, I don't know, maybe four or five times just in the last 2 days, where someone was playing normally and then all of a sudden they got below a threshold or they got frustrated or something and they flipped a switch and all of a sudden they just started just throwing orange chips, which are the $5,000 chips, you know, into the pot just all the time. And it was clear that they had just decided to go big or go home. And one guy said, this is the best hand I've seen all day, and shipped it all in with pocket fives. And, You know, and he didn't have to. I mean, it was not a good play. He was not short stacked enough for that to be a good play. He just did it because he was just, you know, that was it. He decided that, you know, he'd had enough, and that happens a lot in tournaments. I've noticed.
Yeah, tournaments are in a very strange spot right now because, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, players didn't realize the importance of aggression and the importance of mixing it up and being looser. There was much tighter play, and the aggressive players really very often ran over tables. Now a lot of players realize, again, I think it just comes from watching television, you know, just being really aggressive and taking shots and taking risks, that this is a real, this is really the way to play. Well, those players who do that, in fact, have a much better shot at making the money than the players who are very tight and just trying to play almost a poker game as opposed to a tournament. But there is such a thing as a very bad, loose, aggressive player. In other words, they don't really know what they're doing. They're dangerous at the table. It's hard to put them on hands. But when you realize, okay, this guy is just, he's out of it, you know, he's usually going to give his chips away to the few players that basically decide to collect them when they get the cards to do so.
Very good. Now, Ed, we talked about this a little bit earlier, but the book Playing a Player talks about deviating from ABC poker, which that's a strategy that works well against low-limit players but doesn't do so well against the real strong players. Now, if a player is just starting out, is this book too advanced for him to get? Should he start out with your other no-limit hold'em books?
Yeah, no, this is definitely not a first no-limit hold'em book. This is for people who already play decently well, who already can hold their own, break even, maybe do a little bit better, and want to move to the next level. They want to move up a level. They want to start winning a significant amount of money. So, yeah, the book I would recommend to beginners would be Professional No Limit Hold'em, probably. And this one would be after you already feel like you have, you know, ABC poker kind of under your belt. You've already kind of understand how to play that way.
Very good. Now, the last time you were on the show, we asked you about the name of your website, which was notedpokerauthority.com. You said it was a private joke. Now, since this is your second visit, which makes us all friends here, can you let us in on the private joke?
Sure. So I was, I'd just written my first book. It was 2004, and my friends kind of were ribbing me for writing a poker book, I guess. I don't know. They, you know. Yeah. Anyway. And I was out at the Monte Carlo Hotel and Casino, I remember. And we were being dumb and playing blackjack for the free drinks. And I had a number of them. And anyway, we were playing. And the dealer, I made a basic strategy play that the dealer didn't like. I think I hit a soft 18. And
hopefully against a nine or a 10.
Yeah, it was the right play, but she didn't like it because dealers sometimes don't like it when you hit soft 18s and they say something to you. So she said, you know, she said, what are you doing, you know, you have 18, or I don't know. And and my friend stopped her and said, do you know who this is? This is noted poker authority Ed Miller. He wrote a best-selling book on poker.
How many had you sold at that point?
Right. I don't think I'd sold any at that point. And the dealer said, well, he's obviously not a noted blackjack authority. But anyway, this story got told on the internet. And then for a while, for about 2 years, it was like it was my title. You know, it's like, you know, instead of Mr. or Doctor, I was NPA Ed Miller, you know, for Noted Poker Authority. So it lasted about 2 years, and now it's old news and nobody knows where it came from, but that's where it came from.
So does edmiller.com take you to the same place?
I think somebody else bought it. I think it's a Scottish folk singer or something.
And that would be a name that would belong to several people.
Yeah, more than one.
All right. Now, another recent column in Card Player, you called it Stop Playing Poker Like a Slot Machine. And I was offended by the title because I thought you should have said Stop Playing Poker Like a Video Poker Machine. The gist of the article was to play slot machines, you should always make the same strategic moves, and which would be true in video poker, but not slot machines. So, do you accept my criticism of your title?
I don't think there are strategic moves at most slot machines, are there, other than put your money in and pull the handle press the button?
There are. Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, that's how much I know about slot machines.
There are progressives. Yeah. On slot machines, and being able to recognize when a slot machine progressive is at a suitable level, at that point you hit the button as fast as you can. But there is strategy in terms of knowing what those progressive levels are and playing it and not playing it otherwise.
I accept the criticism. To be honest with you, actually, when I was coming up with the title, I wanted to say video poker. But then I remembered my writing teacher saying not to repeat words in the same sentence. And I didn't want to have the word poker in there twice. So I changed it to slot machine. Which may be the worst reasoning ever given, but that's actually what happened. So there you go.
All right, good. All right. So, Ed, in terms of playing no limit home for low stakes, how do casinos in Vegas vary? Are there some that are especially good, some that are especially bad? Should you play by the one closest to your house, or how do you choose between them?
Well, there's kind of, if you're playing at the lowest level, which is usually 1-2 or 1-3 blind, and I should correct that, there are a couple games in town which are 50 cent a dollar blinds, so that would be even half the size. I know they have one at Bill's Gambling Hall at a 50 cent dollar game. So if you want to play 50 cent a dollar, that's the only place I know. It's probably somewhere else. If you want to play 1-2 or 1-3, you have, I don't know, dozens of options to play. There's kind of two different types of rooms. One, there's the main poker rooms in town, which are Venetian, Wynn, Aria, Bellagio, MGM.
They have 1-2 games?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, they all do. And I'm probably forgetting one or two, and I apologize, poker room manager, if I forgot your room. But those rooms generally have 1-2 or 1-3 games where people will buy in for the maximum or close to it. So if you go to play Caesar's Palace, rooms like that, if you buy into a 1-2 or 1-3 game, people will buy in for $300.
Okay. Which is the maximum they're allowed to buy
in? Yeah, usually at a 1-3 game, that will be the maximum. Or they'll buy in for $200. If you go play at a place like Bally's, or which are not major poker rooms, these are places that will only have maybe 2 games going when you walk in the door. People there will often buy in $40, $60, $80, $100. So you're playing a much shorter stack game. If you're a serious poker player, you'll probably want to stick to the bigger rooms where people buy in more in general. But if you do play at Bally's, for instance, I only mention it because I played in that game before, the people will be absolutely horribly terrible in general, your competition, but there will be so little money on the table that you may not want to bother. And the game is also raked the same way. So it'll be, they're still taking $5 off the table every hand, the house is. So it may or may not be worth your time to play those games. So that would be, I would say, the only distinction. Otherwise, if you play in the big poker rooms, the level of competition is I would say roughly equivalent. There's no place I could say, oh, go here for the you know, for the bad players. I think at that level it's pretty equal around town.
And is the amount of the rakes pretty constant from place to place, or some?
There's a little bit of a difference. The Harrah's properties, I believe, in general, rake $5. I think they rake an extra dollar. If you play at the major rooms, and I think the MGM Grand has a slightly better rake in general. They certainly do on their 2-5 game. Their 2-5 game is the best raked 2-5 game in town at the MGM Grand. You're welcome for that plug. mostly you're going to be paying $4 rake, and it's about equivalent everywhere.
Okay, so play at the closest to your house or something. But the local casinos, like the Palms or Red Rock or...
Sure, South Point. There's poker at Green Valley Ranch and Red Rock. And the station's casinos generally have poker. The South Point has some poker. And the Palms has some poker. And I would say certainly at Green Valley Ranch and Red Rock, what I said about the major poker rooms more or less applies. And then probably at the other station's casinos, it's sort of maybe in between. And the South Point. The South Point, at the 1-2 game, people usually buy in for 1 to 200, I would say. And that's what I would expect at maybe like a Texas Station type of place, too.
All right. How many players in Vegas in the, say, 2-5 games and lower do you think are averaging $500 a week? Which is, what is that, $25,000 a year, which is not a one can live on that if one wants to.
Averaging $500 a week at 2-5 or lower. Okay, let's say they're playing 30 hours a week.
Okay.
So that's what, $15 an hour? Okay. Quite a few could meet that bar, sure.
As in 50, as in 100, as in 500?
Probably in the hundreds, I would guess, would meet that bar, sure.
All right. Now, Arnold, when you were playing the small stakes tournaments where you could buy in for $30 or $70, how many people do you think regularly earn that kind of money?
Very few. Again, when I was playing those tournaments, you're talking about 2005, 2006. So I'm sure that the small buy-in tournaments have gone through a lot of changes, just like the major tournaments have, insofar as players' knowledge and what they're doing. But again, you're not going to find any real serious great players playing in a $30 or a $70 tournament. But you have to look at it this way. Let's say you have a 100% advantage. Well, that means for every $30 tournament you buy into, you're going to make, on average, $30. So, well, if you play...
You cash out for 60, of which 30 is offset.
Right.
You're buying.
Now, the thing is, it's not going to run that way. You're going to have a few where you get to final tables. Maybe here and there you'll win one or second place. And a whole lot of them, you're not going to make anything. So it's not going to be for anybody like a regular weekly earnings. But to get up to $500, well, now you're talking about playing, you know, well, 10 of them would pay off $300. I mean, it's conceivably possible that there are players who could make $500 a week or average $500 a week playing in, you know, $50, $100 tournaments. But they're going to play an awful lot. You know, just because, you know, and 100% advantage on $50 means you're going to average $50 for every tournament you play. And you could be in there for hours.
For 2, 3, or 4 hours? How long do these tournaments
last? Well, that is going to depend on the blind structure and the chips and, you know. A lot of the really popular poker casinos like Venetian and Caesars and Bellagio, they don't have those $30 tournaments anymore. You're going to find they're going to be anywhere between 100 up to, you know, 300, 400, 500, depending on if it's a weekend or whatever. I don't remember exactly. I think Bellagio used to have 300 and 500, and Venetian was doing like a 180, and on the weekends it would be a 300 or something like that. And these are these are not the types of tournaments that are considered fast tournaments. These are very different from the $30 and the $70 tournaments. You're going to find some real tournament players in there, especially in Las Vegas, where there's a lot of tournament players and poker players. Your competition's going to be tough, but good players in those events there are probably quite a number of players that could average $500 a week. Again, they're week by week, what they're going to make is going to be very different.
Ed, do you generally concur with his
analysis? Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, if you play the $50 tournaments around town, the players are just absolutely horrendous. I mean, it's the worst poker play you'll ever see if you enter one of those $30 tournaments. But But yeah, I mean, there's just not that much money to win. So it would be a real, you know, and you have this travel time. I mean, the good thing about playing cash is you show up, you get in a game, and you stay as long as you want. So if you want to play 10 hours, you play 10 hours. If you want to play these $30 tournaments, though, you know, you play one here at 1 o'clock, and then you either are in it until – you don't know how long you're going to be in it. You might be in it for 20 minutes. You might be in it for 4 hours. And then you got to hit the next one, you know, and then you have to kind of plan your schedule. So it would be tougher – it would be tough to make $500 a week on average in those small buy-in tournaments, for sure.
All right. Now, on this, on the ring games of 2-5 and so, where you pretty much said it didn't matter where you play, are there players who, if there's a bad beat, jackpot, from 6 to 10 on Tuesdays or something, I mean, and at another casino it's on Monday, and another casino it's somewhere else, are those big enough that it makes sense to travel for, to play during these kind of promotions? In video poker, it definitely is. But in live poker, a small limit, is that?
I think... It's a difficult question because all the major casinos in Las Vegas where you play poker do not have a bad beat jackpot. They don't have any jackpots of any sort. So all the ones I listed, no jackpots.
South Point does.
South Point has one. So, but the, South Point just has high hand jackpots. I don't believe they have a bad beat. Or do they have a bad beat also?
They have a bad beat.
Oh, they do. Okay, that shows you what I know. So I would say the answer is probably actually yes. It's more of a factor in say the LA area where there's a lot of bad beat jackpots, and they get very big in LA. They get over 100,000. I don't know how they have them designed, but they have them designed so they get very big. Certainly, I could see that it would make sense to play at one where there's a huge jackpot as opposed to one with a smaller jackpot, both because you might win the jackpot and also because when there's a huge jackpot, people start to play for the jackpot and just do silly things. Because they want to win the jackpot, which I've witnessed on many occasions. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, a jackpot, you usually have to have four of a kind, and it's got to be cracked.
Right, but what they'll call with preflop with hands, that like a straight, like a 6-5 suited, they'll call like $100 in a 2-5 game. You know, it'll go raise and re-raise, and then they've got 6-5 suited, and they don't want to miss a flop with 6-5 suited. So here they are calling $100. Against kings or whatever with 6-5 suited to try to flop a straight flush. So, yeah.
And it can happen.
Yes, it can. Yes, it can.
All right. Thank you very much, Ed. Arnold, what did we learn tonight?
Oh, yeah, I forgot. You were going to ask me this question. What did we learn tonight?
Now, sometimes Michael Shackelford goes, well, I pretty well knew the subject beforehand, so I didn't learn anything.
Oh, okay.
Now, but you're not allowed to say that. No. Okay. What do we learn?
There are differences between cash games and tournaments, but in some ways there's also similarities. Did we learn that, or does everybody already know that?
Well, I'm kind of learning on poker as we go, and so I'm finding out that I'm learning a lot because I haven't played that much in tournaments, and I've even played less in live. And so, so listening to you guys talk about the differences is educational for me. It's just not my game, and I'm interested in all gambling games, but this is not one I know much about. So,
I actually did learn things because I don't play cash games. So a lot of the things Ed was talking about are things I didn't know. I didn't know that there wasn't that much difference between the major poker rooms and these low limit, no limit hold'em games. I would have thought, somebody who really knows the scene would probably say, oh no, this place is great and that place sucks and this place here is mediocre, but you got to play here. Because I actually hear that's the way blackjack players think. And actually, I think in tournaments, there's more of a truth behind, there's a real difference between tournaments. I know when I was doing low-limit tournaments, the Orleans had much deeper chip stacks, and they had great rebuy structures and big crowds. So they were much better than, say, going over to Sam's Town, where you would always have, like, 26 players, and it was always a $28 buy-in or something, and the top prize was, $600 or something like that. So there were real differences, and I didn't know that. So that's something I definitely learned.
Very good.
The South Point has more than 10,000 video poker games, returning more than 99%. That is more than anybody else. In July, if you play 200 points between 3 a.m. and 11 p.m., you get to spin the wheel for prizes. Prizes include $20 in free play, $50 in free play, 2,500 points, an ice cream cone, food coupons, 2x points all day stuff. So there's a random element involved. Generally speaking, the better your mailer is, the better gifts you get. If you get the $75 a week mailer, most of your spins are going to end you up with $50 free play, which is a real high return on $200 points. If you get a $5 mailer, you're probably going to get 2,500 points, which is worth $7.50, or maybe an ice cream cone. To me, the best prize by far is 2x points. So now that's good between the time you get it until midnight. Therefore, I do my 200 points relatively early in the day. So if I am fortunate enough to get the multiplier, I have time to take advantage of it. So far in July, I have not gotten a 2x point multiplier. In January, when they ran this, I got it like 4x and ended up losing $30,000 taking advantage of the multiplier, but it was a great deal. Anyway, that was that. On Mondays and Wednesdays between 1 and 9 p.m., $1,000 will randomly be given to a player every half hour. At the Palms, the weekly drawings take place Friday, Saturday, and Sunday evenings. 10 players each earn cash, and the top prize is $4,000. Beginning the PEW, Play, Earn, and Win, in July is 5 days a week. It's usually 3 days a week, but July it's five. So for the first 2 weeks, which end tomorrow, Friday, they have gift cards. They have Apple, they have TJ Maxx, they have Omaha Steaks, they have CVS Pharmacy, they have Rebel Gas, they have bunches of them. And they're figured at a rate of 0.33%. So if you're playing 9-6 jacks, and you add in the 0.25 slot club, and so you're already over 100%, assuming the gift cards are worth the same as cash, and you have the drawing equity and mailers, so this is a good deal. So a lot of players are playing it simply because it's a better than 100% game, and it's better than you usually get there. And that also means there's more drawing tickets in the barrel. So it takes more to win the drawings in July than it did in June or May. Now, if you play tomorrow, Friday, they're running short of some of the gift cards. So check at the booth before you start. Like today, they didn't have any of the $50 Apple cards. And so you could have Omaha Steaks, or maybe it was Edible Arrangements. For me, that's not a trade-off that I'm really crazy about. I can spend Apple computers, but Edible Arrangements is not one that's not on the top of my list. So anyway, you check before you start playing as to what they have. Now, starting Monday, the Play, Earn, and Win is still 5 days a week, but it's the top prize is a Kodak camera, and then there's a whole lot of booze, alcohol, rum, gin, stuff like that. So some of you, those are great gifts to have. Others of you, not so much. Sundays in July, they have a swipe your card giveaway in addition to the 2x points for video poker and 10x points for slots, no limits. Very good. Next week, our guest is going to be Dave Stan. He's written a book called Hollywood Blackjack. He has played a lot of blackjack. He has played he's had great success in tournaments. His tournament theories are somewhat different than certain other players, and he's been pretty good in televised tournaments, both as a player and as an MC. His book is interesting, informative, and profane, and maybe not in that order. So if you have virgin ears or eyes, this is not the book for you, but you will learn something, and it's quite entertaining. The class at Samstown this coming Tuesday is 10-7 double bonus. It's free. It starts at 1 o'clock for the beginner class and 3 o'clock for the intermediate class. This is an over 100% game that is still exists at Sam's Town on many of the station casinos and Palms. And plus, the class is a prerequisite for the following week, which is when we're going to teach 9-7 double bonus progressive. The 9-7 is a 1% tighter, but the progressive goes up. At Sam's Town, they have some quarter progressives where the progressive starts at $1,500 instead of $1,000, which it is always over 100%. You get full points there for it. And on many days of the week, it is the best game at the casino for quarter players. So those will be the next two Tuesdays at Sam's Town. We're talking about the classes at South Point starting again in mid-September. All right. Ed, on your book, a lot of it has to do with nits. People who only play the very, very best hands. And so if they're going to bet, you probably ought to stay out of their way. Now, how do you recognize a nit?
Okay, well, nits, I would say the characterizing characteristic, my writing teacher would be appalled, of nits.
Twice in one night.
Right, I know, right? Is that they're afraid. When they're at the poker table, they are in a constant state of low-grade fear. And they are desperately afraid of getting outplayed. No limit hold'em. You can start with two aces, but it's real easy to lose, you know. I mean to be behind after the flop and lose. And these guys are constantly afraid that they're going to get outdrawn, that somebody's going to put them to the test, that they're going to get pushed around, that all this stuff. And the fact is that they're not very good at poker. They don't understand what drives other players. The kind of looser and wilder players who can have anything are kind of a mystery to them, and it's just scary. And so that's anybody who appears actively afraid at the table is a candidate to be a nit. Usually they don't play that many hands, but sometimes they limp in. You know, they'll call $5 before the flop with a fair number of hands, but they're not going to put significant money in the pot on kind of gambling shots. You know, what they do is, you know, if they have two aces, they'll make it, you know, maybe $30 before the flop in a 2-5 game, which is a lot. And then if they get called, they'll bet like $100 on the flop, and they're just hoping you just go away so that they can win your $30 with their aces. And so that's what you'll see them do. You'll also see them fold big hands, and they usually do it face up because they want to show you what a good poker player they are that they can fold.
You always compliment them on what a
absolutely.
Great,
what a great it's fold always it is. A great fold. There has never been a person who folded face up where they did it wrongly.
Is that right?
As far as I'm concerned.
Oh, good. So that would
everyone was right
on that big one for one drop. You would
perfect.
The
well
guy
played.
Who folded the 4-8.
Well done.
I think if I would have had that hand and folded, I would not have showed the hand.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have showed it.
Apparently, Tom Dwan, one of the great players, had to walk away from the table. It upset him so much. All right. Good night, everybody. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes. Good night.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford. Archived versions of past shows may be found on bobdancer.com and wizardofodds.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford are both on Facebook and welcome your input or questions. Our sponsors are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the Palms Casino Resort, the website videopoker.com, and the website wizardofodds.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.
Michael!